The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
This morning I want to get off the beaten track a little bit. We have been concentrating our emphasis more or less upon the message that the prophets had to utter concerning the future, and I have been trying to lay down certain fundamental principles for the interpretation of prophecy. We shall try to tie that up tonight and tomorrow night. But the question, of course, arises, did these men speak in a vacuum? Did they just appear upon the scene and talk about the future and have no relevance to the day in which they lived? What is that relevance and significance, if any? This morning I want to speak along that line because I think this is a practical emphasis that we also need to keep in mind. Just a few years ago, possibly not more than 20 or 30 years ago, there was a great emphasis in the church upon what was called the social gospel. Now this, I think, can readily be understood. If you look back at the 19th century, you'll realize that toward the close of that century, there appeared upon the scene a rather complex, or I might say a complex, of religious views. In the field of theology, Albrecht Ritschl was predominant, and he stressed value judgments. He is a forerunner of the phenomenon that we call modernism in the church. In the field of New Testament studies, Adolf Harnack was speaking about his purely human Jesus, the great teacher, the great man, the great reformer, and so on. In the Old Testament field, there was the development theory of Julius Bellhausen, which was really based upon an evolutionary view of man, of progress from the lower to the higher. And then you find that all of this in the field of philosophy was more or less undergirded by the philosophy of Hegel. It all hung together and came into the churches in the form that was known as modernism. Now, the evolutionary philosophy seemed to imply, in the practical field at least, that things were improving in the world. They were getting better and better. Man was realizing that war was not the answer to his problems, that by means of war he could not solve his problems. And so it was assumed that man was evolving, progressing on towards something better. Before the First World War, I understand someone made the statement that man had too much of a sense of humor ever to engage in war again. There was a constant emphasis upon the progress of mankind. And then the First World War broke out, and then the Second World War, and we realize that this idea of progress has been shattered. But now accompanying that, there was this phenomenon known as the social gospel. The idea seemed to be that the real lack in the world was to be found in man's environment. A man in poverty could never do the best. Poverty was one of the great enemies of mankind. Another enemy of mankind was ignorance. So if we could educate people, and if we could take them away from poverty, then they could make something of their lives. And there was also coupled with this a depreciation of doctrine. The modernists were very intolerant of doctrine. What was needed was ethics and life. I remember taking a course once in a theological seminary. It was not Westminster Seminary, but there was a professor there who was enamored with this social gospel. And he was simply concerned that we go out and clean up society, that if we could simply give people the proper places in which to live, there would no longer be any slums. And if we could simply educate them all, our problems would practically be at an end. There always remained the one great problem of war, but if man could simply sit down in a reasonable fashion and discuss the horrors of war, Why, then they would see that nothing was to be gained by going to war, and we could abolish war entirely. Now that is all a beautiful dream, and that keeps cropping up all the time. The social gospel is not dead. I think it has changed its appearance somewhat, but it is still with us. And I can certainly sympathize with those who have a feeling of compassion for others that are less fortunate than themselves and want to help the lot of other people. I would like, however, to point out in this connection, before we actually get to the prophets, that it is often said that fundamentalists and conservatives have a hard heart. They are not concerned about the welfare of other people. They simply want men to be saved, and they don't care about their earthly existence. That isn't actually true. Dr. Carl Henry, who has just written a book on this subject, I haven't read his book yet, but I've been in correspondence with him about it. Dr. Henry told me that they had a panel discussion about his book at Wheaton College in Illinois. And in the course of this discussion, somebody made the statement that Dr. Henry was the kind of person that would be perfectly willing to pass by, as the priest did before the Good Samaritan, and see the man in agony and suffering there, and be content just to give him a tract and go on and leave him in his condition. Now, Dr. Henry, of course, didn't like that because it was a misunderstanding of his book. And anyone that knows Dr. Henry knows that that is not his attitude. I do not think that is the attitude of any true Christian. And I would simply call to your attention the fact that those who throughout the history of mankind have been responsible for the establishment of schools and universities, for the establishment of hospitals, have been Christians. I would also call to your attention that in Germany today, there is a very wonderful institution at Bielefeld, which was begun by evangelical Christians. It was begun by a Lutheran pastor by the name of Bodo Schwing, and this man realized that something should be done to help men who were out of work. And he made it possible for such men to work. Now he helped them so that they could retain their self-respect. And that is a wonderful thing to do. The institution grew until at present there are something like 14,000 people connected with it. That it not only provides work for those that are willing to work, but it also provides instruction in some of the trades. There are hospitals there and orphanages. And what impressed me particularly was the care that was shown to the mental deficient. There was loving care shown to those people by nurses who are themselves Christians. I went through those institutions a few years ago, and the German pastor that took me through explained the whole thing to me. And what impressed me was that it was not just taking unfortunate people and solving their problems by giving them money. That doesn't really help anything. But concerned with it all was a love for these people, a real concern about their welfare, and a desire to make it possible for them to help themselves so that they could be self-respecting men and women. And I think that is the way we must go about it. Evangelical Christians have had a concern. I don't know what your arrangement is in the Baptist Church, but in the Presbyterian Church we have the Deacons Fund, and the deacons are supposed to have a concern for the poor. And they do have, and they have helped many people. I just want to defend the church at this point. I do not agree for a minute with the charge that is made that all we are concerned about is to stand in the pulpit on Sunday and preach about heaven and not have any concern about how people live during the week. And if someone is starving and in trouble, we simply pass him by. I do not think that has been true at all. Now, of course, no Christian has fulfilled his responsibility as he should. You can point the finger of accusation at any Christian, and there's no question about it. No Christian has done what he should have done. I think we would all agree to that. But I do not think that the modernist and the outside world is in any position to point a finger of accusation against Bible believers. I do not think it is true that we have not been concerned about what are sometimes called social questions. I simply challenge that. The fact that we do not go along with some of the schemes that are presented does not mean that we have no concern, that we have no heart, that we have no pity. For there is a great intolerance in this matter today. And the idea is not that you have a concern. The idea is that you must go along with certain programs. And if you do not do that, and if you dare to criticize or evaluate these programs, then you have no heart. You have no concern for other people. You are cruel, you are hard-hearted, and all the rest of it. And that is the thing to which I object. Now, these advocates of the social gospel appeal to the Bible, and they believed that they were following in the footsteps of the prophets. The prophets, they said, were social reformers. The prophets were concerned also with the problems of the poor and others round about them. And they came up with social schemes for the amelioration of the condition of these people. Now I want that we look today at one passage of Scripture to see just what is true about the position of the prophets. But before we do that, I want to say this. That a great deal that is offered today as a panacea for the solution of the world's ills is based upon a misunderstanding of human nature. You cannot simply go out and build fine dwelling places and put people in them and think that you are rid of the slums. That is not the way it works. Because the slums are in the human heart, and we need to realize that fact. I happen right now to live in an apartment house, and it's supposed to be a very nice apartment house. It is a nice apartment house, but I'm not the only one that lives in it. There are other people that live in it, and I want to say that some of these people get good salaries, far better salaries than I get. But you should see the way they dispose of their garbage. The place looks like a slum where certain people live. And they don't need welfare aid. They've got plenty of money. Some of them have 2 and 3 cars and television sets. And what more can there be in life than that? But the place looks abominable. They leave newspapers and garbage at their front door anywhere else. There's dirt and there's filth. Well, what should we do? Build still better apartment houses for them? That's not the answer. Now, there are some of us, if we found that we were living in a place that was infested with rats and so on, and disease, some of us just wouldn't be content with that. We'd do something about it. If we couldn't do anything else, we'd get a hold of a cat somewhere. But human beings are different. And we need to recognize that elementary fact. I think one of the worst errors that is spread abroad today is this doctrine of egalitarianism, which is just another way of saying that everybody is alike. And all you have to do is pass certain laws and pass out money, other people's money, and you solve the problems. Now, I think the whole thing is mistaken. And coupled with that is this idea that we are all responsible for the environment of certain people. And if people coming from a poor environment commit crime, they are not to blame for that. It's the environment that's responsible. And really, you and I are responsible because we've never done anything about it. Instead of standing up here and preaching the gospel, we should be out doing something about these people. What? I don't know. But it's our fault. Now, that's the emphasis that is given today. Here's trouble in one part of the city. Well, that's our fault. Those people can't be blamed. It's their environment. Put them in a better environment. Give them an education, and this would all stop. Now, you know that that kind of thing goes over the airwaves all the time. It's in the newspapers. It is propagated constantly. And you know also that from the Christian standpoint, that is just as false as it can be. We are not responsible for the things that men do. Our Lord Jesus Christ was poor. Jesus Christ had not where to lay his head. But Jesus Christ, in a certain sense, we may say, was above his environment. And do we not know the stories of many men that have risen above their environment? There are some who make their opportunities and who get ahead and will do it. And there are some who will never lift a finger, no matter how much money they have, no matter what they have. Education is no solution. My friends, when the social reformer uses the word ignorance, he is misstating the case. He does not understand the case because he does not know what ignorance is. The way to get away from ignorance is not to give anybody a college education per se. It is the fear of the Lord that is the beginning of wisdom. And unless there is the fear of the Lord in the heart, a man is not educated. For the modern education is based upon naturalistic principles. It is fundamentally mistaken at its very center. A man is not educated. He does not see things as they are until he is born of the Spirit of God, and he bases all of his thinking upon the fact that God is the Creator and this is God's world. And so when men talk about ignorance today, all they mean is that the person may not be able to read or write or doesn't have a college education. But giving a college education to a person does not remove crime. It does not take sin out of the human heart. It simply makes it possible for that person to sin on a greater scale. And some of the worst sinners are people that are supposedly educated. In other words, the reformers today do not even see the problems, let alone have an answer for those problems. And consequently, we cannot degrade the prophets by bringing them down to this level and saying that they approached it all from this same standpoint. I want you now to look at what Isaiah says on this, and we'll consider the first chapter of his prophecy, a few verses in that chapter, and I think we will see that there is quite a different approach here. And what we must do is approach these problems in the same way that the prophets have done. Now he begins in verse 2 with this remarkable cry, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken." This begins with an alliteration. Well, it does even in the English. Hear, heavens, both begin with H. Give ear, earth. Their ear and earth both begin with an E. In the Hebrew, Shimu, Shamayim, Vahazini, Eretz. It has a certain force to it there. Hear, O heavens, give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. And he uses a word for speak here that is not quite as frequent as one other word. It is, I think, deliberately chosen to call attention to the speaking of the Lord. The heavens and earth are to hear now, for God has spoken. Now, right off, Isaiah shows himself conscious of divine history. The reason why he appeals to heaven and earth, which are of course inanimate, is not that this reflects some old polytheistic view of a deity of heaven and earth, but rather because at the formation of the nation, at Mount Sinai, Moses had appealed to heaven and earth as God formed Israel into the covenant nation. Now, midway between Moses and Christ, Isaiah again appeals to heaven and earth. For now the Lord who formed this nation, is speaking, and they are to hear his message. The message is given in the latter part of this verse. Sons have I nourished and brought up, and they have rebelled against me. Now there is the heart of the matter. The emphatic word is sons. I have nourished and brought up, and they have rebelled against me. There is his message. God has done everything for this nation. He speaks as a father. They are his sons. He has adopted them. And then he has done what a father does. He has brought them up. He has nourished them. He has provided for their welfare. God has given them all that they need. But they, notice the disjunction there, I have brought up, they have rebelled against me. They and me. They have rebelled against me. That is the history of Israel. So that the prophets, you see, are going to speak to a rebellious nation. And that is the fundamental point that we need to remember. In all of this matter of social reform, let us remember that there is something wrong and that something wrong is not in the environment, it's in the heart of man. And that has to be righted if there is to be any genuine progress. Now, I know very well the answer that's given to that. That's too simple. That's old-fashioned and so on. Be that as it may, I think that that is what is needed above all else. If the heart of man is changed, then these other things seem to straighten themselves out also. Now, I don't know who first said that cleanliness is next to godliness, but I do know this, that when a man is born of the Spirit of God, there is a change in his whole life. I was in Africa, in Ethiopia, just a year ago, and had the privilege of visiting in some of the native huts and so on. Those people have none of the conveniences of life. But what impressed me was that even there, when you went into the hut of a Christian, there was a cleanliness about the place that was not found elsewhere. There is something about the fact that when the heart of man is changed, his environment is changed. The Christian wants to be clean, and he wants that around him to be clean. And I think Protestantism can take the credit for the fact that those who are Protestants try to live a clean life. They want their homes to be clean. There's just something about this matter of leaving garbage all over that does not square with a Christian faith. The Protestant wants to take his responsibilities seriously. In his dealings with other men, he wants to be above board. Even if he doesn't have money, he can straighten out his little home to the best of his ability. And the more men understand the Scriptures, the more the world round about them is improved by them. There is just something in that, that when men have the truth of God, it does affect their lives. The heart of man must be changed. Now Isaiah goes on in this next verse to illustrate his point. He takes a kind of a proverb and says that the ox knoweth his owner and the ass his master's crib. Israel doth not know, my people doth not consider. Just notice there that statement, my people. This is a favorite expression of Isaiah, which is found throughout the prophecy. It begins this section just as it begins chapter 40, comfort ye my people. God is speaking here of Israel as his own people. My people do not consider. Now, there is a rather interesting comparison here. It is, first of all, the comparison between animals and man. And it simply means that animals act more wisely than men do. The ox knows its owner, knows who takes care of it. The ass knows the crib of its master, that is, knows the place where its master puts the food. The animals have intelligence enough to know that, but Israel, who is my people, don't know that. It's first of all then a comparison, you see, between animals and man. Now, more than that, it's a comparison between animals that are dull and sluggish and slow of wit and an enlightened people of God. In the 1001 Nights, the Arabian Nights entertainment, there's one story about the ox and the ass. I'm putting it in my Arabic grammar as a reading selection for the poor students that have to study Arabic, but I'm trying to get in something at least there that is interesting. The Arabian Nights are very interesting. I don't know that they serve any other great purpose, but at least they have that in their favor. They are interesting to read. And there's one of these stories about the ox and the ass. And the ox and the ass get together, as I recall it, in order to outwit their owners so that they will be fed without working. They aren't very successful at that, however. You don't think of the ox and the ass as wise animals. It's the fox that is usually called the father of sagacity in Arabic literature. The fox is the sly and the cunning one, but not the ox and the ass. They make an attempt at it, but it doesn't work out very well. And they come out on the bad end of things at the end of the story, as I recall it. So the ox and the ass, then, are not exactly clever, intelligent animals, but they know who takes care of them. Israel, the enlightened nation, the nation that had the law of God, that has the prophets, the chosen people, they don't know. They are not as intelligent as these dull and sluggish animals. But then there is a third point in this comparison. It is not only a comparison between animals and man, between sluggish, dull-witted animals and an enlightened nation, but it is also a comparison between animals whose master cares nothing for them, who only feeds them in order that he may get work out of them, and sons of a loving heavenly Father. And that brings out the heinousness of Israel's sin. The owner has no affection for the animals, but if he doesn't feed them, they will die. And yet they are wise enough to know where their food comes from. But the sons of the heavenly Father, who have been raised and brought up and nourished by God, they do not even know that their heavenly Father takes care of them. They're not as wise as the animals. So that is the comparison or contrast that the prophet brings out here. Now he speaks to them by way of an appeal. And in verse 4, you will notice that he makes four statements. He begins with this word translated, ah, which in Hebrew would be pronounced hoy. It's a kind of an ejaculation, a cry of sorrow, of despair, really. Hoy. And in the first three words, there is the presence of the O sound. Let me pronounce them for you, because the Hebrew is very effective through devices of this kind. Hoi, goi, hote. That is, alas, nation, sinning. The participle is used. It means sinning. If you will look at these four phrases, you will find that there are four nouns here. A nation, a people, a seed, and children. These set forth what the nation was designed by God to become, what the people should have been. It should have been a nation, a chosen nation, a people, a peculiar people, a seed, a heavenly seed, children, the children of God. Those nouns point out what it should have been, what God had designed it to be. Then accompanying each noun is a qualifying word which shows what the nation had actually become. It is a nation, but it is a sinning nation. That's really stronger than to say sinful. It is a nation sinning. Alas, a nation sinning. That is the first cry that the prophet utters. A nation, think of what it should be, but it is a sinning nation. A nation that misses the mark, that goes astray, rebels against God. It is a people, yes. It should be God's people, but what kind of a people is it? It is a people literally heavy with its iniquity. That is, weighted down by its iniquity, by its treacherous dealings. It is a seed, a generation, yes, but a generation of evildoers, mere'im, men who do evil things. They are children, yes, but they are children that corrupt, that deal corruptly. And then the verse closes with three statements. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger. They are gone away backwards, or they have turned aside, fallen backwards. Three things are stated here which point out the iniquitous dealings of the nation and point out the condition into which it has fallen. Now, I think even here you can see that the prophet is concerned about the way the people live. These words, sin and iniquity, deal in the Hebrew primarily with the idea of rebellion against God and of dealing iniquitously. But they are corrupt, and they are those that do evil. These things are condemned by the prophet. He does not allow for a minute that his people can do this sort of thing. He condemns them for it. And then he appeals to them in verse 5. Why do you do it? And in verse 6, he describes the whole body politic in the figure of a man that is sick, whose entire body is covered with bruises and sores. Then he appeals to them to show in verse 7 that their country is desolate and so on, and that had it not been for the Lord of hosts, who has left a remnant, the nation would have perished just as did Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah, we know, were iniquitous cities, and the Lord rained fire and brimstone upon them and destroyed them. This country is like Sodom and Gomorrah. And proceeding a step further in verse 10, Isaiah addresses them as Sodom and Gomorrah, rulers of Sodom and people of Gomorrah. Now, what was the trouble here? What was wrong in the Judah of their day? Well, it was not what we would call a dead orthodoxy. Orthodoxy is never dead. The word orthodoxy just means right teaching. And when you have right teaching, there is life. Now, the reason why there seems sometime to be no life lies not in the teaching itself, but in the fact that some of us have an ability to make the truth as dull and uninteresting as we possibly can. And that's why there sometimes seems to be no life. But when the truth is preached, there is life. There really is no such thing as dead orthodoxy. I think what you have here, rather, is what Feuerbach called a living hypocrisy. And that is what is present here in Judah. And that is the thing that Isaiah condemns. Now, I think all churches probably have to contend with just this thing. There are those who, in effect, believe that if they attend the service of the church, they can do anything they want to. That that is all that is required. And that was the trouble here. To what purpose, Isaiah asks, is the multitude of your sacrifices unto me? I am full of the burnt offerings of rams and so on. Why all this religious worship? Now, these people were orthodox in their profession. Let me make clear what I mean. They named the name of the Lord. These sacrifices were offered in the name of the Lord. They belonged, if you want, to the Orthodox Church. If you went to the city of Jerusalem and asked these people where they went to church, if I may use modern terminology, they said, "We go to that church over there," pointing to the temple, where the name of the Lord dwelt, where the established religion of Israel was found, the Orthodox religion. That's where they went to church. "We are Orthodox," they said. In effect, "we go to church there." But God is rejecting all of their worship. He will have none of it because their hands are full of blood. Now, what is the trouble here? The trouble is that they allow unjust rulers to rule their kingdom. And this is the emphasis that the prophets make, that there is a lack of justice in the land. That is the way the prophets deal with respect to the poor. That is their concern, that the poor, by which they mean not only those that have no material substance, but those who are unable to defend themselves, the widow and the orphan, that these people do not have a square deal in the courts of the land. They are mistreated by others that are more powerful than they. Now, I realize it's probably a very precarious thing for me to say anything about what I think the functions of government are, but I'm going to say just this. I am more and more convinced that the functions of government, according to the Bible, and that is really the one standard we should go upon, are protective. The government has the responsibility of protecting its citizens from outside enemies. It must do that. If it fails in strong defenses, it's failed as a government. It also has the duty of protecting its citizens from one another. And I'll even say it has the duty of protecting its citizens from itself. It has to protect its citizens from one another, because human nature is corrupt. And when a man gets a certain amount of power, he is very likely to take advantage of others. Now, Lord Acton said that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Last week I heard that statement denied. It was said that was not true. I don't know, but my experience has been that it doesn't take very much power for a man to let it go to his head and take himself a little too seriously. And I have seen, and you have seen, I'm sure, where people who have a certain amount of power take unjust advantage over others. Now, we hear one of our problems stated this way, as a kind of a conflict between capital and labor. Capitalism is a word that is used a great deal today, And we know there is a conflict between management and labor, capital and labor. Some people seem to put the matter this way, as though everything that is capitalistic is ipso facto good, as though everything that has to do with a labor union is ipso facto wrong. Others put it the very way around, that capitalism is in itself an evil thing, and that labor in itself is a good thing, or labor unions in themselves are good things. Now, I can't agree with that way of stating the problem, because I don't think that even gets at the issue at all. If, let us say, you hire me to do a certain job, why, there is nothing wrong in that. If you pay me what you believe I am worth, what the job is worth, then I think you have fulfilled your responsibility to me, and I have a responsibility to do that job to the best of my ability. Now, when that is done, why, I cannot see that anyone has done anything wrong. Every now and then I try to get someone to type my manuscripts for me. And I offer to pay a certain price for that, that we agree upon to be reasonable, and then the typist does the work. Now, if I have paid a fair price to her, why, there can be no complaint about that. If she does a fair job on the typing, there can be no objection to that. I happen to have hired her. That is not sinful. She happened to have worked for me. That is not sinful, is it? And if we both live up to our agreement, why, everything is fine. But if I try to get work out of her without paying for it, or without paying a fair price for it, that is wrong. And if she tries to do the work in a slipshod way just to get the money, and hands in work that is not well done, that is wrong. You see, I think, what I'm getting at. In the way the world is constituted, there must be some that will employ, and those that will be employed. But it is human nature, it is sin that creeps in, and causes one to take advantage of the other. And it is when men take advantage of another that then the evil creeps in. Now, we are not going to have an answer to this problem in this life, because sin is with us. And what we need, therefore, is protection from the government. I think in our country, for example, that when Hoover was Secretary of the Commerce, that he was right, and that it was part of his function to go to some of the steel manufacturers in Pittsburgh and insist that they provide better working conditions for their men, that they do not demand and make inhuman demands out of their workmen. And so he was able to get a shorter working day and better working conditions for some of these men. I think that that is a legitimate function of government, because that is protecting certain men against the greed of other men. And that seems to me to be the basic function of government, that it must protect. Now, it will never do this perfectly, because even those who rule are sinful men, and they have prejudices. And we know that they have prejudices. And so we make a great mistake if we think that human government is going to solve all problems. It isn't going to solve them. It can't solve them. And what we as Christians, I think, must do is see, as far as we are able, that everybody gets a square deal. Now, that is sometimes a difficult thing to do, but that is our responsibility. And that is the thing that Isaiah is contending for. There is no point, he is saying, in effect, for your coming to worship. You're going through the forms of worship when you allow a lack of justice in the land, when you do not raise your hand in opposition to this, when the poor, the widow, and the orphan are ill-treated, they do not receive their just deserts, then you cannot simply pass that by. And so he says, regarding their worship here, that their hands are full of blood. That is, they are responsible for the innocently shed blood, for the blood of the innocent that has been shed. They are responsible because they have done nothing about that. I think you see that he is getting at this point here, that we have responsibility in our citizenship. We cannot shut ourselves off from the world round about us. We cannot lock ourselves up in our room and say, well, I'll study the Bible and let the rest of the world go by. Not at all. We have a responsibility. And if we exercise that responsibility, sometimes I think you'd be surprised at the amount of influence that we can exert. The world needs to see justice. It needs to see fairness. Now, sometimes there's a great stress upon fairness, but that fairness applies to only one side. The fairness must apply to all who are concerned. Now, that's difficult, of course, because even good men sometimes differ among themselves as to just how to implement laws to see that fairness is given to all. And no one can say that the solution of these problems is crystal clear, because there are so many ramifications in them. And when you want to do right, you wonder just how you can do it. Seems to me there's only one thing we can each one take to heart, and that is this. In the choices that come before us individually, one by one, then let us make the choice which in our heart of hearts we believe is right, which will do the most justice, and see that the most justice is carried out. So Isaiah is condemning this nation because it has a lack of concern for the welfare of those round about. Justice is denied. Lives are taken. Blood is shed. The people are unconcerned. They worship God. What more then can anyone desire? He, however, concludes with 9 imperatives. Wash you, verse 16, make you clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before mine eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do well. Speak judgment, that is justice. Relieve the oppressed. Judge the fatherless. Plead for the widow. Those, in other words, that cannot defend themselves, you must plead for them. You must judge them. You must see that they receive just treatment. And then come now and let us reason together. Now, this passage seems to me to set this forth almost as clearly as anything in the prophets. These men did not exist in a vacuum. They did not show a lack of concern about the conditions existing in their day. But I want you to notice where the emphasis lay. They never advocate the position that you just should tax everybody heavily and pass out the money all around as though that were somehow going to be a solution of the problem. We have to remember that there is the right of private property too, and the government can steal just as much as anybody else can steal. We have to remember that. But what is necessary is that justice be shown unto all. This is not going to solve the world's problems, because even when justice is shown unto all, there are some people who will not lift a finger to do anything. We have to remember that. There are people that do not care, that do not want to get ahead, that do not want to better themselves. They are perfectly content to sit down all day long and simply to loaf. Once in a while, I guess I envy them. But there are plenty of people just like that. And we have to remember that. What is needed is that justice is seen. Now, the New Testament is very clear that mercy be shown to people. And that we must do. That the church, that Christians help others. And I really believe that in Christian love, where we take account of the needs of people, and we distribute to the feeding of the poor and so on, then a great deal of good can be accomplished. But the prophets were not just social reformers. They were men with a passion for a true justice, and every one of us must have that. Otherwise, our countries will go to pieces. There must be just this. There's one other thing that needs to be noted here. The higher critics, some of them, have said that Isaiah would never have dared to speak this way if their law of Moses had already been in existence, because he is condemning their sacrifices, and the law of Moses enjoins sacrifice. Now, I do not think that is a correct understanding of this passage. If Isaiah is condemning sacrifice per se, just notice that he goes on and condemns prayer also. And if he is really condemning sacrifice in itself, he is also condemning prayer in itself. And surely that is not the case. Isaiah simply condemns a false prayer. There's no point in spreading out your hands in prayer when your lives allow a lack of justice to exist. And so what he is really saying is that you are misusing the commands of God. You are misusing sacrifice. You are misusing prayer, as long as you allow these sins to continue. I think then you can see that the message of the prophets is very relevant, that they did have a concern that all people be treated well, and that the religion of the people be founded upon morality, be founded upon justice, and so on. Then if the people could see that the widow and the orphan received justice, if they could see that the principles of their religion were carried out into everyday life, then it would be that they could come before the Lord and their worship would be accepted. Is not this a fundamental truth that the prophet is setting before us here? Is not this something that we all need to learn? We cannot, as Christians, separate ourselves entirely from the world. Yes, we must worship God. That worship must be at the very heart of our life. But we cannot be impervious to our brother's need and to his difficulty. For when we see him in need, and when we see him suffering, we must do what we can to meet that need. We must see that he receives justice. That, it seems to me, is the great emphasis that the prophets laid down. And if all of us had that same passion and same concern to see that justice were administered in the land, many of the problems would, I think, then be taken care of. Thank you.